The Kingdom of Cards by Rabindranath Tagore. Once upon a time, there was a lonely island in a distant sea where lived the kings and queens, the aces and the knaves, in the Kingdom of Cards. The tens and nines, with the twos and threes, and all the other members, had long ago settled there also. But these were not twice-born people like the famous court cards. The ace, the king, and the knave were the three highest castes. The fourth caste was made up of a mixture of the lower castes. The twos and the threes were lowest of all. These inferior castes were never allowed to sit in the same row with the great court castes. Wonderful indeed were the regulations and rules of that island kingdom. The particular rank of each individual had been settled from time immemorial. Everyone had his own appointed work and never did anything else. An unseen hand appeared to be directing them wherever they went, according to the rules. No one in the Kingdom of Cards had any occasion to think. No one had any need to come to any decision. No one was ever required to debate any new subject. The citizens all moved along in a listless groove without speech. When they fell, they made no noise. They lay down on their backs and gazed upward at the sky with each prim feature firmly fixed forever. There was a remarkable stillness in the Kingdom of Cards. Satisfaction and contentment were complete in all their rounded wholeness. There was never any uproar or violence. There was never any excitement or enthusiasm. The great ocean, crooning its lullaby with one unceasing melody, lapped the island to sleep with a thousand soft touches of its waves' white hands. The vast sky, like the outspread azure wings of the brooding mother bird, nestled the island round with its downy plume. For on the distant horizon, a deep blue line betokened another shore. But no sound of quarrel or strife could reach the island of cards to break its calm repose. In that far-off foreign land, across the sea, there lived a young prince whose mother was a sorrowing queen. This queen had fallen from her favour and was living with her only son on the seashore. The prince passed his childhood alone and forlorn, sitting by his forlorn mother, weaving the net of his big desires. He longed to go in search of the flying horse, the jewel in the cobra's hood, the rose of heaven, the magic roads, or to find where the Princess Beauty was sleeping in the ogre's castle over the 13 rivers and across the 7 seas. From the son of the merchant at school, the young prince learned the stories of foreign kingdoms. From the son of the Kotwal, he learned the adventures of the two genii of the lamp. And when the rain came beating down and the clouds covered the sky, he would sit on the threshold facing the sea and say to his sorrowing mother, "Tell me, mother, a story of some very far-off land." And his mother would tell him an endless tale she had heard in her childhood of a wonderful country beyond the sea where dwelt the Princess Beauty. And the heart of the young prince would become sick with longing as he sat on the threshold looking out on the ocean, listening to his mother's wonderful story, while the rain outside came beating down and the grey clouds covered the sky. One day, the son of the merchant came to the prince and said boldly, "Comrade, my studies are over. I am now setting out on my travels to seek my fortunes on the sea. I have come to bid you goodbye." The prince said, "I will go with you." And the son of the Kotwal said also, "Comrades, trusty and true, you will not leave me behind. I also will be your companion." Then the young prince said to his sorrowing mother, "Mother, I am now setting out on my travels to seek my fortune. When I come back once more, I shall surely have found some way to remove all your sorrow." So the three companions set out on their travels together. In the harbour were anchored the 12 ships of the merchant, and the three companions got on board. The south wind was blowing, and the 12 ships sailed away as fast as the desires which rose in the prince's breast. At the conch shell island, they filled one ship with conches. At the sandalwood island, they filled a second ship with sandalwood. And at the coral island, they filled a third ship with coral. 4 years passed away, and they filled four more ships, one with ivory, one with musk, one with cloves, and one with nutmegs. But when these ships were all loaded, a terrible tempest arose. The ships were all of them sunk, with their cloves and nutmeg, and musk and ivory, and coral and sandalwood and conches. But the ship with the three companions struck on an island reef, buried them safe ashore, and itself broke in pieces. This was the famous Island of Cards, where lived the ace and king and queen and knave with the nines and tens and all the other members, according to the rules. Up till now, there had been nothing to disturb that island stillness. No new thing had ever happened. No discussion had ever been held. And then, of a sudden, the three companions appeared, thrown up by the sea, and the great debate began. There were three main points of dispute. First, to what caste should these unclassed strangers belong? Should they rank with the court cards, or were they merely lower caste people, to be ranked with the nines and tens? No precedent could be quoted to decide this weighty question. Secondly, what was their clan? Had they the fairer hue and bright complexion of the hearts, or was theirs the darker complexion of the clubs? Over this question, there were interminable disputes. The whole marriage system of the island, with its intricate regulations, would depend on its nice adjustment. Thirdly, what food should they take? With whom should they live and sleep? And should their heads be placed southwest, northwest, or only northeast? In all the kingdom of cards, a series of problems so vital and critical had never been debated before. But the three companions grew desperately hungry. They had to get food in some way or another. So while this debate went on, with its interminable silence and pauses, and while the aces called their own meeting, and formed themselves into a committee to find some obsolete dealing with the question, the three companions themselves were eating all they could find, and drinking out of every vessel, and breaking all the regulations. Even the twos and threes were shocked at this outrageous behaviour. The three said, "Brother Twos, these people are openly shameless." And the two said, "Brother Threes, they are evidently of lower caste than ourselves." After their meal was over, the three companions went for a stroll in the city. When they saw the ponderous people moving in their dismal processions with prim and solemn faces, the prince turned to the son of the merchant and the son of the Kotwal, and threw back his head and gave one stupendous laugh. Down Royal Street and across Ace Square and along the nave embankment ran the quiver of this strange, unheard of laughter, the laughter that, amazed at itself, expired in the vast vacuum of silence. The son of the Kotwal and the son of the merchant were chilled through to the bone by the ghost-like stillness around them. They turned to the prince and said, "Comrade, let us away. Let us not stop for a moment in this awful land of ghosts." But the prince said, "Comrades, these people resemble men, so I am going to find out, by by shaking them upside down and inside out, whether they have a single drop of warm living blood left in their veins. The days passed one by one, and the placid existence of the island went on almost without a ripple. The three companions obeyed no rules nor regulations. They never did anything correctly, either in sitting or standing or turning themselves round or lying on their back. On the contrary, wherever they saw these things going on precisely and exactly according to the rules, they gave way to inordinate laughter. They remained unimpressed altogether by the eternal gravity of those eternal regulations. One day, the great court cards came to the son of the Kotwal and the son of the merchant and the prince. "Why," they asked slowly, "are you not moving according to the rules?" The three companions answered, "Because this is our Ichcha." The great court cards, with hollow, cavernous voices, as if slowly awakening from an age-long dream, said together, "Ichcha." "And pray, who is Ichcha?" They could not understand who Ichcha was then, but the whole island was to understand it by and by. The first glimmer of light passed the threshold of their minds when they found out, through watching the actions of the prince, that they might move in a straight line in an opposite direction from the one in which they had always gone before. Then they made another startling discovery, that there was another side to the cards which they had never yet noticed with attention. This was the beginning of the change. Now that the change had begun, the three companions were able to initiate them more and more deeply into the mysteries of Ichcha. The cards gradually became aware that life was not bound by regulations. They began to feel a secret satisfaction in the kingly power of choosing for themselves. But with this first impact of Ichcha, the whole pack of cards began to totter slowly and then tumble down to the ground. The scene was like that of some huge python awaking from a long sleep as it slowly unfolds its numberless coils with a quiver that runs through its whole frame. Hitherto, the queens of spades and clubs and diamonds and hearts had remained behind curtains with eyes that gazed vacantly into space or else remained fixed upon the ground. And now, all of a sudden, on an afternoon in spring, the Queen of Hearts from the balcony raised her dark eyebrows for a moment and cast a single glance upon the prince from the corner of her eye. "Great God," cried the prince, "I thought they were all painted images. But I am wrong. They are women after all." When the young prince called to his side his two companions and said in a meditative voice, "My comrades, there is a charm about these ladies that I had never noticed before. When I saw that glance of the queen's dark luminous eyes brightening with new emotion, it seemed to me like the first faint streak of dawn in a newly created world." The two companions smiled a knowing smile and said, "Is that really so, prince?" And the poor Queen of Hearts from that day went from bad to worse. She began to forget all the rules in a truly scandalous manner. If, for instance, her place in the row was beside the knave, she suddenly found herself quite accidentally standing beside the prince instead. At this, the knave, with motionless face and solemn voice, would say, "Queen, you have made a mistake." And the poor Queen of Hearts' red cheeks would get redder than ever. But the prince would come gallantly to her rescue and say, "No, there is no mistake. From today, I am going to be knave." Now it came to pass that, while everyone was trying to correct the improprieties of the guilty Queen of Hearts, they began to make mistakes themselves. the aces found themselves elbowed out by the kings. The kings got muddled up with the knaves. The nines and tens assumed airs, as though they belonged to the great court cards. The twos and threes were found secretly, taking the places specially reserved for the fours and fives. Confusion had never been so confounded before. Many spring seasons had come and gone in that island of cards. The coquille, the bird of spring, had sung its song year after year, but it had never stirred the blood as it stirred it now. In days gone by, the sea had sung its tireless melody, but then it had proclaimed only the inflexible monotony of the rule. And suddenly its waves were telling, through all their flashing light and luminous shade and myriad voices, the deepest yearnings of the heart of love. Where are vanished now their prim, round, regular, complacent features? Here is a face full of love-sick longing. Here is a heart heating wild with regrets. Here is a mind racked sore with doubts. Music and sighing and smiles and tears are filling the air. Life is throbbing. Hearts are breaking. Passions are kindling. Everyone is now thinking of his own appearance and comparing himself with others. The ace of clubs is musing to himself that the king of spades may be just passably good looking. But, says he, when I walk down the street, you have only to see how people's eyes turn towards me. The king of spades is saying, why on earth is that ace of clubs always straining his neck and strutting about like a peacock? He imagines all the queens are dying of love for him. Why, the real fact is... Here he pauses and examines his face in the glass. But the queens were the worst of all. They began to spend all their time in dressing up to the nines, and the nines would become their hopeless and abject slaves. But their cutting remarks about one another were more shocking still. So the young men would sit listless on the leaves under the trees, lolling with outstretched limbs in the forest shade, and the young maidens, dressed in pale blue robes, would come walking accidentally to the same shade of the same forest by the same trees, and turn their eyes as though they saw no one there, and look as though they came out to see nothing at all. And then one young man, more forward than the rest, in a fit of madness, would dare to go near to a maiden in blue. But, as he drew near, speech would forsake him. He would stand there, tongue-tied and foolish, and the favourable moment would pass. The cockle birds were singing in the boughs overhead. The mischievous south wind was blowing. It disarrayed the hair. It whispered in the ear and stirred the music in the blood. The leaves of the trees were murmuring with rustling delight, and the ceaseless sound of the ocean made all the mute longings of the heart of man and maid surge backwards and forwards on the full springtide of love. The three companions had brought into the dried-up channels of the kingdom of cards the full flood tide of a new life. And, though the tide was full, there was a pause as though the rising waters would not break into foam but remain suspended forever. There were no outspoken words, only a cautious going forward one step and receding two. All seemed busy heaping up their unfulfilled desires like castles in the air or fortresses of sand. They were pale and speechless, their eyes were burning, their lips trembling with unspoken secrets. The prince saw what was wrong. He summoned everyone on the island and said, bring hither the flutes and the cymbals, the pipes and drums. Let all be played together, and raise loud shouts of rejoicing, for the Queen of Hearts this very night is going to choose her mate. So the tens and nines began to blow on their flutes and pipes, the 8s and 7s played on their sackbuts and viols, and even the 2s and 3s began to beat madly on their drums. When this tumultuous gust of music came, it swept away at one blast all those sighings and mopings. And then what a torrent of laughter and words poured forth. There were daring proposals and locking refusals, and gossip and chatter, and jests and merriment. It was like the swaying and shaking and rustling and soughing in a summer gale of a million leaves and branches in the depth of the primeval forest. But the Queen of Hearts, in a rose-red robe, sat silent in the shadow of her secret bower and listened to the great uproarious sound of music and mirth that came floating towards her. She shut her eyes and dreamt her dream of love. And when she opened them, she found the prince seated on the ground before her, gazing up at her face. And she covered her eyes with both hands and shrank back, quivering with an inward tumult of joy. And the prince passed the whole day alone, walking by the side of the surging sea. He carried in his mind that startled look, that shrinking gesture of the queen, and his heart beat high with hope. That night, the serried, gaily dressed ranks of young men and maidens waited with smiling faces at the palace gates. The palace hall was lighted with fairy lamps and festooned with flowers of spring. Slowly, the Queen of Hearts entered, and the whole assembly rose to greet her. With a jasmine garland in her hand, she stood before the prince with downcast eyes. In her lowly bashfulness, she could hardly raise the garland to the neck of the mate she had chosen. But the prince bowed his head, and the garland slipped to its place. The assembly of youths and maidens had waited her choice with eager, expectant hush. And when the choice was made, the whole vast concourse rocked and swayed with a tumult of wild delight. And the sound of their shouts was heard in every part of the island, and by ships far out at sea. Never had such a shout been raised in the Kingdom of Cards before. And they carried the prince and his bride, and seated them on the throne, and crowned them then and there in the ancient island of Cards. And the sorrowing mother queen, on the far-off island shore on the other side of the sea, came sailing to her son's new kingdom in a ship adorned with gold. And the citizens are no longer regulated according to the rules, but are good or bad, or both, according to their ichcha.